This interview was a turning of the tables as Rhonda Willers changed roles from interviewee to interviewer, posing the questions to Kate Fisher on April 19th of 2015. Kate received a BA in art history and a BA in studio art from St. Olaf College. She was an education supervisor for a small nonprofit and an artisan on public commissions at RDG Dahlquist Art Studio before completing her MFA at the University of North Texas. Prior to her arrival in Minnesota, she worked for Anderson Ranch Art Center in Snowmass Village, Colorado. While Kate's ceramic beginnings are deeply rooted in functional wares, she has continued to honor utilitarianism while simultaneously developing a body of sculptural forms. Her work is either for or about home. Home not just as a specific place or structure, but also a feeling or geographical location. Fisher's work has been exhibited locally, nationally, and internationally. She has traveled to China, Europe, and South America to enrich her artistic studies. Kate is currently the technical assistant and a visiting assistant professor for the Department of Art and Art History at her alma mater, St. Olaf College. She lives with her husband and two children in St. Louis Park, Minnesota. I hope you enjoy this conversation.
In your questionnaire, you listed three women as role models for clay moms. You have Jan McKay Johnston, Eva Kwong, and is it Jeannie Hulin?
Yep.
Hulin.
Okay. Yep.
Hulin. What are some of the qualities or reasons you feel these women are role models?
Well, I put all of those people down because I felt like they all had and still do have really rich careers. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, they seem to have found some sort of a balance in their life. And I think, and I picked all of them for different reasons. You know, for example, Jan, I feel like I know her on a really personal level, so I probably know the most about her story. I've always remembered her telling the story about how she made slab baking dish forms.
You know,
these, well, I call them the
drape molds.
Yeah. But how she made those forms and how those forms came from, you know, finding that that was the perfect thing to do when her kids were little because she could start them in the morning and then they go down for a nap and she could do this part. And then, you know, they'd get up again. And the whole process of her day was perfectly matched to make that one object. Mm-hmm. And I found that to be really interesting to me because I love that form of hers. And I guess I've always thought of all, you know, baskets and all these other different forms that we think of with jam, but you know, it makes that object more interesting to me. And so, you know, that's one reason I picked her. You know, here's a person, you know, who is able to find one form and really make one form for a number of years and still enjoy making that form and also to have a really great career. And for her, I picked her too, because I think that when I think of Jan, I think she's somebody who really enjoys being a mom.
Yeah.
And it's really important to her and it's a big part of what she does. And I think she also really enjoys being a potter and enjoys making her work. And then Eva, I picked Eva because, you know, I know she's a mom and I also know a lot of the things that she has said in regards to being a mom through another person in this whole interview process. And also when I wrote to her about being in the exhibition, she was so well-spoken on that subject. She had such kind, wonderful things to say, which just reinforced what I already knew about her kind of thinking. But I think she's really pro mother and pro making mother not a four little word, you know. Jeannie, I don't really know her all that well. I know her through a mutual friend and I really enjoy her work. And then, you know, I also know she's, you know, the chair of her department and she just had, you know, a huge solo show at NSICA. You know, and I know she rolled up to our exhibition, you know, with her kids in tow and, you know, had it all together. And I'm completely amazed by her. And when I talked to her a little bit, I was really amazed by how she talked about balance in life. And so that was another reason I put her down.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that these women know they're viewed as role models, or do you think it's more that they just built a life that matched their own personal goals?
I don't know. I mean, I don't think if you asked Jan, do you know you're a role model? I think she would laugh at me.
Yeah. I think you might be right.
I don't think they do. And I think that's okay. I think I think you could take any other subject and you know, poll people who are the role models for this field, you know, pick whatever field you want. And I think there, if you went to those quote role model folks, mm-hmm. I bet a lot of them wouldn't even know that they're role models. Mm-hmm. And I think that's okay.
Yeah.
You know, I think those, you know, those women too, in particular, Jan and Eva, well, we also get to look at them, you know, with that kind of retrospective lens, because both of them are, you know, mothers of children who are grown adults. Mm-hmm. And so they're completely through the phase. And Jeannie is, you know, has younger school children, but she's still past the kind of baby phase. So, mm-hmm. you know, that changes how we view people too.
Something else I found kind of interesting is when you mentioned the feeling of the studio clock ticking and missing opportunities to do good things in there. I wondered if that feeling came more from like within, or if it was developed by like looking and comparing to what others were doing.
Yeah, I think that looking and comparing thing is really hard, because a lot of times you're comparing apples to oranges. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're looking at somebody who is, you know, another woman in the field who is single, and, you know, especially single, not married, no children, in their 40s, mm-hmm. they have a whole different kind of flexibility than somebody who, even just somebody who's married, yeah. let alone if you have kids or multiple kids or whatever. So I also think you got to think about that too, the apples to oranges thing, because it's not the same. And then also you have to think about, okay, is it somebody who's a studio potter? Somebody who's a studio potter, you know, is dependent on that studio for a living. And so therefore they are putting more time into that versus mm-hmm. somebody who's in academics or somebody who's, you know, working for a nonprofit or what have you. So I'm always really conscientious if I do any sort of comparing. For one, I try not to compare, because I don't really think, you know, it doesn't make any sense. I would, if I'm going to do anything to think about that kind of success and opportunity, I would look more internally, you know, what do you need to be happy internally yeah. versus externally? Mm-hmm. That's a big one for me.
It's like, but more what your personal goals for your work
yeah,
is.
Yeah, what are your personal goals versus, mm-hmm. you know, what, I don't know, what the community's goals are for me?
Yeah.
I don't know. I take that all with a big grain of salt anyway. You know, I don't think we even know what our own goals are for each other. As far as that kind of feeling like you miss out on opportunity, I totally feel like I miss out on opportunities a lot of times. And it's usually, you know, my own doing, because mm-hmm. I have a million things going on and, oh, that deadline came and went.
Yes.
Totally forgot about it. You know?
And I'm like, ah, crap.
Yep. And I do that a lot, and I don't really worry about it. I feel like as long as I, you know, maintain 4 shows a year minimum, I feel fine. There's not a hole in the resume. And that's really all I'm after at this point, is making sure I've got at least 4 good shows and that I don't feel like there's any sort of big gap or hole. And, you know, if there's a year where there's more, that's great, but it's not that big of a deal, you know? And I also think you have to look at that kind of opportunity in a lot of ways, because, you know, there's show opportunity, but there are other opportunities too. Like there's community engagement opportunities, you know, there's opportunities with NSECA, there's mm-hmm. opportunities, you know, with writing, mm-hmm. there's opportunities of this nature of, you know, creating a community and doing something else. So, mm-hmm. you know, I just try and kind of think about what opportunity really means. I think I used to have a really narrow view. Well, it has to be a residency or a show, or it has to fit into one of these 5 categories over here. Yeah. But I don't really think of it that way anymore, because I think opportunity is a much bigger word.
I really liked your idea about the sabbatical from your studio and the professionalism that phrasing really brings to the idea of a break or the maternity leave. And can you tell me more about like when and why you decided to call your maternity time that instead of like maternity leave?
That's a good question. I think that we, for whatever reason, have a hard time taking breaks from our studio. Mm-hmm. And I think that something happened in this field where there's this pace that we work at when we're getting our master's, when we're getting your MFA, or probably even your BFA too, you know, mm-hmm. and somehow we feel that that's the pace that we should always be working yes. at going forward.
So true.
And yeah. it's bullshit.
Yeah.
And there's no other way around it. It's bullshit.
Yeah.
Because there's no way that you can possibly work at that kind of pace for the rest of your life and be healthy.
Right.
And I think it is.
And have healthy relationships.
Exactly.
Around.
And I yeah. remember when I was in graduate school, one of the deans at our school, who was not, you know, not a clay person or whatever, but an art person, pulling me aside when we were talking one day and talking to me about the pace that I was working and the doing things, and that I really needed to realize that I could not work at that pace forever and what it would do, you know, and he was really adamant about how that would impact relationships. And, and I remember listening to all this and, you know, completely writing it off in a way at the time. And, but it, having it really ring in my head and resonate. And I think there are about five conversations or critiques I've ever had that still stick in my head. And I keep all those words in my back pocket. And so I've taken what that person said to me to heart, and I think he was right, you know, and I think that if I had stayed at that kind of pace, I would have never had a relationship. I would have never had a marriage. I would have never had kids. I would never have found joys in riding my bike, in running and all of that. And I am really adamant that the quality of life that we have is just as important as working in the studio. And I don't think that working in your studio all the time is healthy.
Yeah. You know,
I think it's somehow justifiable in our field, but if that person was in finance, we'd think that they were some sort of like an egomaniac workaholic. But somehow if we do it, it's okay because
we're in the pursuit of the creative, right?
That exactly. So when I had Willow, first baby, I remember having a really difficult time not being in the studio and being really flustered by the whole process of having her. And there was no way I could have gone in that studio. We had a baby who wouldn't eat. And it is really the most horrifying thing if you have a kid who you have to wake them up every 2 hours to eat. And so my full-time job was to get that kid to eat. And so that really took away from the ability to be in that studio. And then I tried really hard, and I had made a lot of pots before she was born, so I had a good stockpile to work from for quite a while.
That's smart. That was good.
That worked out really well. And then I kept trying to make pots. I kept trying to make pots with her, and I ruined everything. I mean, I ruined almost all the work I made, and I was getting really frustrated, and I just finally had to let it all go because Dan broke his collarbone.
Oh, and then
yeah, and so I had to take care of both of them. That was the game changer for me because I really had to stop and put everything aside for a little while. That was a really good thing because I looked at my work totally from a different kind of perspective and a very reflective perspective.
You wouldn't have gotten to do that. I mean, because like you had just mentioned, like it's hard for us in our field to stop working. And like,
we don't stop working. That's the whole problem. People think, oh, I just keep working, work. Well, you don't ever stop and then kind of reflect on it and go do something else. That was kind of the first round. Second round, you know, Fisher comes along and I did a pretty good job, you know, not quite as good, you know, making work before he came. And then he came and I knew I had this exhibition in the fall. You know, he was born in March that fall. I kept thinking about what I was going to make. And I made a series of pots that I thought I would kind of, that would become that show. But again, I mean, it was like, I didn't learn the first time. You can't make pots. Like you cannot make pots with a kid. It just doesn't work. You can't stop mid cup and go get them. And so what I did that round was I got a little bit smarter because as Willow needed care when she was younger and Dan broke his collarbone, I started drawing more. And I've never been a big drawer. And so I approached it from a very different kind of perspective. When that show was coming then that fall, the whole idea was that we were going to do a series of drawings for it. And so the person who I was working with, it was 365 drawings, so one a day. Wow. She was very letter of the law. She did one drawing a day. I'm more spirit of the law.
Yes.
And so I did one drawing a month, and then I cut that drawing down to the size of, you know, what each drawing was supposed to be per day. And so then I cut each drawing into 30 pieces. That was a really great thing because then I was making work every day. And then for that show, I decided to make a series of sculptures that mimicked the drawings or that I worked on in the same way that I worked on those drawings. And I wanted that that series and that for myself, but I also felt like it was probably going to be an open and shut series. Like I'm going to make it for this show and then it's going to be over. That's it. And I'm glad I did it because I think it has, I worked in a totally different way. And I really enjoyed the way I was working and the process of working, but I didn't, I think, you know, I've had some time to reflect on it now. I think I know what I need to do next. And I don't think I would have figured out that what I need to do next if I hadn't stopped. And so the studio sabbatical that I talk about, I decided to take it to work on this project.
Yeah.
Because there was no way to do, you know, my job with the school and do my studio and do my home and, you know, attend to my body and, you know, make it work. Something had to go. Something had to go to get rid of the anxiety. And so all I had to do was say, it's a sabbatical from my studio. It's okay to take a sabbatical from teaching. Yeah. But why the hell isn't it okay to take a sabbatical from your studio for a few months to reflect on what you need to do next, to do research for what needs to happen next? I am totally willing to tell the clay world that, yes, I do stop making work from time to time. And that I feel like when I go back into my studio, I do a much better job.
Mm-hmm.
That's not to say I'm not making anything. I do demos at school every day. Yeah. I throw pots every day. You know, I'm still in the practice of it. It's not like I've abandoned the field or anything.
Right. You're not touching it anymore.
No, no. But I do feel, and I do feel like, you know, knowing that I have a large space at the college next year to exhibit, it's a huge wall to exhibit on for, you know, half the year. And I know exactly what I need to make now. I know exactly how to do the next thing. And I would have never come to that conclusion without a break. That's why I call it that. And also the idea of studio sabbatical, it's a semantics thing, you know? I think one of the other things we need to think about is that idea of maternity leave, because maternity leave, I'm sorry, for one, I could get on a soapbox for hours about how it's a BS system in this country.
Yeah.
But also, I think that it has the word mom, the word maternity, all of that stuff has such a negative connotation.
Because people view it as an entitlement now instead of as a natural right or a necessity to take care of children. They think it's an entitlement that women who choose to be mothers want. That drives me insane.
Oh, it all drives me really crazy. But yeah, I think there are some serious things that we need to think about as a country in terms of mothers' rights and of fathers' rights too, for that matter. We all know it. The statistics are out there, you know, on our pay.
Go back after 6 weeks even. It's like,
it just breaks my heart.
I know, I cannot fathom 6 weeks. Like, 6 weeks hurts me.
So one of the other things I will say about this whole idea of maternity leave and studio sabbatical, I remember when I had, pretty sure it was with Fisher, and somebody, you know, asked me, well, you know, what are you making these days? Are you making new work? And I'm thinking, as I'm like holding this little 2-month-old baby. And I remember after that conversation was over, walking to my freezer, opening the freezer and taking a picture of the gallon of frozen milk that was currently in my freezer and thinking to myself, oh yeah, I'm making new work right now. Here it is. It's called Liquid Gold. It's a beautiful installation.
It's so much work.
But I don't, that's something that I don't think that person would understand. They don't have children. Of course, they're never going to understand it. But that's something that I think the world needs to understand, is that process alone of feeding a newborn is really important, and it's really difficult. And I've had two very different experiences. I've had one child who absolutely would not eat to save their life, and I had another child who was ravenous.
Yeah, you know, continuously. But then you also had to change your diet for the one that was super
hungry. And the one that was ravenous, I had to completely change my diet for an entire year. Yeah. And it was very important that he was, you know, could stay, you know, breastfed that whole time. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that to me was a beautiful piece that I made. You know, I was so proud that in the summer I was home with him, that I was able to save 2.5 gallons of milk. I mean, that was a feat. And I don't think people realize that, you know, if you sit down to feed a child every 2 to 3 hours, my kids were 2 hours on the button.
That's a minor. You know?
And then when they're done with that, then you're also going to hook yourself up to a pump for at least 15 to 20 minutes. That's a huge amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that huge amount of time, then you're also asking a person who's sleep deprived, are you making work? What kind of work are you making right now?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's just, it's so unrealistic and it's unfair and it doesn't honor what that person just did.
What would be a better conversation starter for someone like to approach people who have just had a baby? Like, what would be a better way for them to talk to you? You know what I mean? Like, what can they say? Like, what else?
I'm going to use Jess Parker's words to answer that question, because I feel like in the whole process of this project, she was the one person who had the best answer. And I could not say it any better myself, so I'm not going to try. Mm-hmm. And she said that clay is like a river and it runs through her backyard. Mm-hmm. And it's always going to be there. Mm-hmm. And that if she feels like she needs a little bit of it, she can go out and dip her cup in and take a drink. Mm-hmm. And if she feels like she needs a lot of it, she could go out and she could just jump in that river. Mm-hmm. And I think that's exactly the way we need to think about it. It's always going to be there. Your studio is always going to be there. It is not going anywhere. The clay community is not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. It'll always be there for you. Mm-hmm. That baby will not always be little. And that baby will not always need you the way they do when they first come into the world. Take the time and give it to them, and mm-hmm. your studio will be waiting for you when you're done. And I think that that is an appropriate way to talk to somebody about that whole process.
And just, yeah, like the next time someone asks, just say, right now, my focus is on my children. And yeah, and like unapologetically so. I mean, I think that's...
And I think the reason people kind of apologize for the amount of time they put in, or, you know, tiptoe around it or whatever it goes back to that thing that if you're not going at, you know, pedal to the metal pace all the time, you're not worthy of any attention, or you're not working hard enough. And it's not healthy. That's the bottom line. Yeah. It's not healthy for you. I think we all need to think about that balance of life too. You know, I think it's not just with kids, but also, you know, with like your aging parents, mm-hmm. you know, is another big thing that I think all of us are going to encounter at some point in time too. Illnesses. I mean, in the last 7 years, my husband has broken his collarbone. I broke my hand. Mm-hmm. That took me out of making work for, you know, a good 6 months. I broke my hand. There's nothing I can do. Look at Krista Assad. She was, she's been taken out of work, you know, and things like that happen. And so I think you have to think about, you can make peace with yourself when something mm-hmm. like that happens, that it's mm-hmm. not the end of the world, you know, and if you have to resort to drawing, or you have to resort to writing, or, you know, collaging in a sketchbook, that's fine. Mm-hmm. You know, like, that information is so helpful later on.
I mean, think about Matisse. There's all those stories about him being on his bed doing his paper cutouts and telling the nurse how to help him arrange the pieces.
You know, when it had a period of his life, the same kind of thing. I think it's just how we approach those points in time.
What kinds of opportunities do you hope to pursue in the future when your children are a bit older? You mentioned kind of idea of some being out of reach for young art mothers. Like, what can be done to change that along the way too?
Okay, here's the number one thing I think people could do. A lot of places talk about, and I say this all with a grain of salt, but about being more inclusive. One of the things that I would suggest too is, you know, if you think about trying to do any sort of a short-term residency or a workshop, it is pretty much impossible to do that when you have small kids. And especially if you have small kids and your spouse or your partner is in some other field other than clay, and they are unable to just pick up and move with you. Yeah. And so I feel like that's a massive population of people who are not able to participate in those things that I don't think are recognized at all. So one of the things that I think would be great is if, and I'm going to throw out some examples, I don't mean to point fingers or anything, but let's say, you know, Red Lodge Clay Center, Northern Clay Center, you know, Philadelphia Clay Studio has some sort of short-term residency option, and they partner with some sort of a daycare or some sort of a care provider, because I think that if you were to offer to parents in this field the opportunity to have even a half a day of daycare, that would be more of a scholarship than anything else. Oh. I think that would be fairly simple to make a possibility. And then at the same time, you could do something for that care center or that care person that would be some sort of a payback, you know, going into a daycare and doing a small program with kids mm-hmm. with the material to educate them about what is going on. That would be a great form of programming that would make that opportunity available to a population that is underserved. And it would also, you know, I think could allow for a really great civic engagement opportunity with another population that is potentially not engaged in the idea of clay and what it's about, or, you know, how it could become part of what they do. So that would be one really simple example. Mm-hmm. But I do think if places could be a little bit more inclusive to people who have younger children and thinking about how to make those opportunities. Because I think a lot of those opportunities are really geared towards somebody who's young and nomadic. And I think that absolutely. I think that because those opportunities are always geared towards some young nomad, mm-hmm. then anybody who is not that young nomad is unable to take on that kind of opportunity. And then I think what's happened is that we've perpetuated that the only way that you can be, quote, successful within this community is to maintain that nomadic single lifestyle.
Yeah.
In which case, I don't think that we are talking about a very healthy situation in terms of relationships and family and all kinds of other things that I think are really important to people. When you're talking about opportunities,
yeah.
you know, one thing I have to say, and I had, you know, no community either when I had yeah. kids. And so one of the other opportunities that I've been really interested in is figuring out a community. You know, I came into Clay and I love all of my mentors greatly, but all of my mentors, all of my teachers were all men.
Yes.
And they were all childless men. Many of my good friends in this field have been men. Mm-hmm. And so when I had my kids, I didn't really think about my gender at all mm-hmm. until I had them. And then all mm-hmm. of a sudden, oh my gosh, those people who I've been friends with are not going to be any real support system to me here yeah. because they're men and they don't understand what I'm going through. My mentors aren't going to be of any help to me now. And so I probably felt more alone after I had kids than ever before because of that. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea how to do this whole thing.
You referenced guilt in your questionnaire and you said guilt from time away in the studio, guilt from time away from your kids, and even guilt from your thoughts or decisions to take time away. What can you or anyone do to justify or validate that decision, those decisions, so that the guilt doesn't take away from like your valuable mental space?
I think guilt and motherhood go hand in hand in this country. And that's all there is to it. And if you can find a mother out there who can get through a whole description of herself and her children and her career without using that word, I would love to meet them. But I do think that guilt is a huge part of motherhood. And I don't know what the solution is for it at all. But I do acknowledge it. And I think it's, to me, acknowledging something is usually a big step towards figuring it out. So mm-hmm. that's the first thing. Second mm-hmm. thing is, in this whole process of this project, that became one of the biggest things that mm-hmm. I heard over and over was a sense of guilt. And so I've really tried to be a little bit more conscious in thinking about it. And mm-hmm. I do think that it's important, you know, to acknowledge it. And I do feel guilty. I feel guilty when I'm in my studio because I have somebody who's caring for my children so that I can make work. And mm-hmm. I guess what I should really be thinking is that that time in my studio is just as important as my time at a college. Although mm-hmm. my time at a college comes with a guaranteed paycheck. So yes. it's much easier to justify having a babysitter for that period yes. of time.
What advice do you have for young mothers or young artists who wish to have a career in art and a life as a mother?
Ooh, good question. So I'm going to start off by saying that this is all coming from a person who never planned on having kids. Mm-hmm. It was never a big thought in my head. Who was educated by really wonderful teachers, but all teachers who were childless men. And so I felt like I had absolutely no sort of conversation or education about how to even make all this happen. And after I had Willow and I realized that most of my really good friends in this field were men, I pretty much felt alone because I could go to a mom's group, but mm-hmm. they had no understanding of the guilt I felt from not being in a studio. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I could go to a Clay group, but there may or may not be people who could have a conversation with me. And I don't know them, so I don't know how much they want to talk about that kind of stuff anyway. And so I guess the first thing I would say to those people is it's totally fine. You can do it. The community will always be there for you if you take the time that you deserve to take with that child in the beginning. It'll always be here and you can come back to it at any time. But I would also say find people in this community. Find people in the Clay community who have done it. Find other women in this field who have done it, whether they're in the trenches, so to speak, right now, or they have children who are in middle school or high school, or they have grown children. find those people and let those people be a support system for you. I also don't think it's okay to tell people that they can't do it or that, you know, you have to somehow choose between a career in clay and children. I'm not okay with that. I think that that's just a bunch of leftover baggage from the first wave of feminist artists. And I'm not really interested in entertaining any of that conversation at all. And that's fine if you want to make that personal decision for yourself, but I don't think it's something you need to perpetuate with other people. The one thing I think women also need to hear is that fertility is not infinite. It is finite. I think we live in some strange universe where we have this image of our fertility being an infinite thing. And I don't think that that's helpful for people. And so that's the big thing. And you never know also how long it might take you to get pregnant from the point at which you decide you want to have children until they become a reality. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. For more information or to listen to additional interviews like the one you just heard, please visit www.bothartistandmother.com. Funding for this project was made possible by St. Olaf College's Academic Innovation Fund. Special thanks to Caleb Ganheimer for his audio editing, the Ericksons for their music, Heather Wang for her transcription skills, Rachel Elizabeth Murphy for her web expertise, and to all the artist mothers. Thank you.